When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, it's going to be a short show. We're going to cut all this shit out.
Yeah. Who else is a pain in the ass, Julie?
Who isn't?
Yeah.
Why don't we start in a
Well, we've been starting. We have to cut it off because Julie came in and just started bad-mouthing famous people. So it's I'll have to throw this all out. Hey, Joe, what did you do this weekend?
I went to see this cool play.
It's not a play. It's a musical.
Well, it's a play.
It's a musical play.
There
is
you
it that one about the
by the love
the
of
singer,
the glove.
The singer in the glove.
It's about this singer, yes, famous singer.
It's very funny.
With us.
Yeah,
and it's very very funny.
It's very
funny. Very clever and really well sung.
Yes, it is.
Well acted.
Yes, it is.
I recommend it.
It's got the funniest Tinkerbell gag. That's all I'm going to say. and we don't talk about people's work. Julian pretends to have listened to our show before, then he crammed.
Well, we should probably let people know a little bit.
Should we plug a little bit?
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about that.
Because if they don't live here, they can't see the play.
Well, that's true. So we have to make this
until it goes on the road.
And they don't know who I am.
Well, no, we never say. We don't like to say the names of the people.
Plus, there's like the Masked Singer. Like, who's your guest today?
Well, no. Have you ever listened to a? It's impossible to get a podcast without finding out who.
Right. Exactly.
So but they're going to know.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean they are aware of the compliment.
Right. But they can Google them.
It'd be a lot simpler to just go through.
Just like Google the guy, look up who's on the show, Google him, and figure out what's going on.
It's too much work. People don't want to do this kind of work to listen to this show.
This is The Movies That Made Me with your hosts, Josh Olson
and Joe Dante.
Guest is Julian Nitzberg, mm-hmm. Who is right now, first and foremost, the creator, writer, director.
Yeah.
And co-songwriter? Is that?
I wrote the lyrics.
Wrote the lyrics music, to the song for The Love of a Glove, which is an amazing musical that Joe and I and a packed house full of other people saw this weekend, and people have been seeing for several weeks, and that is showing at, tell us quickly,
the Carl Sagan,
where is it?
It's the Carl Sagan and Andruian Theater. Andruian is Carl Sagan's widow, who produced all the Cosmos episodes and still produces Cosmos. It's in Echo Park, Los Angeles. If you go to fortheloveofaglove.com, you can find tickets. And
it's still there, and it will still be there for a few more weeks.
Yeah, we're extending, so it's going to be.
Oh, you are? Great. Until when?
End of March.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay.
And maybe longer if we keep selling.
Great. Yeah, no, please. It is terrific, and folks will enjoy it. And Julian has done some other things as well. I first crossed my radar with an absolutely amazing doc, which I believe you can get now on Amazon Prime. Called The Wild, Wonderful Whites of West Virginia, which is pulls off the high wire act of being going deep into the lives of these people in Kentucky. It is screamingly funny.
West Virginia.
And what did I say?
Kentucky. The Wild and Wonderful Whites of West Virginia who live in Kentucky.
Yeah, that's the first clue. I have Kentucky on my mind. I apologize. I was talking to a friend in Kentucky this morning about your film, which he loves.
This is why Trump's going to win, people like you.
Exactly. You want to know something crazy? This is insane. I was going to be talking to this guy in Kentucky a few days ago.
The primaries in Idaho just ended. It was a mess.
And
Iowa.
What? Iowa.
Yeah.
No, Kentucky. Anyway, you're confusing
the whole thing
me.
Off.
So I'm trying to, we're making plans to have a brief phone conversation. And I'm like being the fucking idiot. I'm like, wait a minute, Kentucky, is that, which time zone is that in? And I go, I'll look it up on my iPhone. I'll look at the clock, right? Mm-hmm. You have the clock and you go to World Clock and you punch in the name of a place. And I punched in Kentucky.
Yeah.
And nothing came up. It's absolutely insane.
It's been eliminated.
You want to know why Trump is president? It's because you can't pull up Kentucky on your iPhone. That is why Trump is president. Yeah. In any case, Wild Wonderful Whites of West Virginia, it's screamingly funny, but it's also incredibly powerful look at poverty in America. And it paints this somehow incredibly bleak and yet at the same time entertaining and hilarious portrait of this part of the world that, you know, if you're us smug coastal elite assholes, you're just kind of oblivious to outside of the occasional Burt Reynolds comedy. It's a wonderful film. It is a really wonderful film. I've been a fan for a long time. And it seemed like a perfect opportunity to bring you in.
Yeah.
Since you got a show and you're plugging something and we're the last place to plug anything since we don't talk about your work. But and we thought we'd have you in.
Okay. Well, so the work relates to, you know, the theme I picked because it.
Yes. Tell us about you have a theme.
So the new show is a musical about the life of Michael Jackson as told by his glove, who's an alien from another planet and happens to.
Spoiler.
Not ruin too much, but but it's also like a very political work. So it's what I did with Wild Whites. I hope, you know, where I mix, you know, really filthy humor with political commentary so that, you know, you don't give people. The annoying, like, and here's the lesson you're going to learn. You're laughing, and then the politics kind of seeps in through the side as opposed to clobbering you. At least that was my intent. So.
May I also add, as a connoisseur of puppetry, that this show has some great puppeteering. Sometimes the characters, particularly when they're children, are played by puppets that they're, you know, puppeteered on stage by the people who will then sometimes play them when they're adults. Yeah. And it's just a tremendous achievement, I think.
Yeah, the first act is the Jackson 5 years. So all the Jackson 5 are played by puppets when they're kids. We didn't want any kids on stage because all the humor is filthy.
Yeah.
And the second and the second act is the year Thriller is made. So, and you know, obviously part of the power of Michael Jackson is he gets his power from this alien who looks like a glove. And of course, he has to put his hand inside the alien, which is up his ass. And then, of course, the alien seems to love it a lot.
Well, and then he has to grab his own crotch with the alien.
The alien is the one who...
Right.
Because, you know, part of it was trying to reconcile. A big part of it is being a Jehovah's Witness and what it means. And their religion actually teaches that you turn gay by masturbating. Masturbating can turn you gay which everyone knows is true because you get used to a man's hand on your penis and you want other man's hands on your penis. And this is really in... Like Jehovah's Witness, like people think I made this shit up. They're like, you're just ridiculous. But Jerry Minor, who stars in it, was raised Jehovah's Witness. And, you know,
oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So
I'm guessing he's broken with the church.
He left when he was 19 or 20.
Okay.
Yeah. And the other big part of it is Michael's relationship with Donny Osmond, who was basically the Osmonds were created as the white, cynically created as a white Jackson 5, while they're members of the Mormon church. Which was the last major white supremacist church in America, which did not let black people into their temples till 1979 and taught that all black people had the mark of Cain, which eventually is God turned them black as punishment. But when Cain and Jesus returned from the dead, all black people will eventually turn white again. And part of the show is Michael gets revenge on Donny Osmond.
And it's amazing how you tie all this stuff into the story of Michael Jackson that we all know and love.
Yeah.
Because you're waiting for him to turn white and you're waiting for him to grab his crotch and you're waiting for all these things to happen.
Yeah.
You've given it this great context. But we're going to have to cut all this because we're talking about his work.
Well, it's going to tie into my favorite
movies. Then.
Yeah.
Fine then. What are you going to talk about musicals? You're going to talk about a certain type of musical.
I'm talking about musicals that deal with politics and or religion, like, you know, that are political musicals as opposed to musicals that are just fun. And and you know, I love all sorts of movies, but I grew up with my mom loved Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies and Marx Brothers movies, so those were kind of the two big influences on my childhood. And then as I got older, I got into like the weirder stuff, and so I kind of want to talk about the weird things that, you know, now that I have this show open and you guys invited me on the show, it's like, what were the major things that just scarred me and made me able to write this? And which were the musicals that, you know, or, you know, that deal with politics in an interesting way.
You know, we've run into the, there's that Netflix show now, Movies That Made Us, which is an extension of the toy show. And it's
Bastards.
You know, I'm very fond of our name, but it's a little, but you know, I think we should have gone with the movies that scarred us. That might be.
Yeah.
Well, go. What do you got, man?
Well, I'm going to start with some obvious. I'll go back and forth between obvious and like ones where we'll see if we can stump Joe Dante or not. So, you know.
Can't be done.
What?
Can't be done.
Really? Okay. I'm
stumped already.
Oh, and before I go any further, the composers on my musical are Nicole Morier, Drew Erickson, Max Townsley, and Nicole is like your biggest fan. So she was so excited that I was coming on the show.
Oh,
so,
great.
She couldn't believe it. So, first one, obviously, you know, growing up in New York, you grew up in Philly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there were certain movies that every year played at the same time and you'd watch it over and over again. And one of them in New York was The Producers.
It's so simple. Step one, we find the worst play in the world, a surefire flop.
Ring time for Hitler.
Step two, I raise $1 million. A lot of little old ladies in the world.
I love you.
What?
I love you.
What?
I love you!
Step three, you go back to work on the books. Only list of backers, one for the government, one for us.
Hey, God, I'll do it! You got it!
Step four, we open on Broadway. Step five, we close on Broadway.
Step six, we take our $1 million and we fly to Rio de Janeiro.
My mom was a Holocaust survivor, and so, you know, all my grandmother's siblings, except for one, died in concentration camps or died right after. And, you know, I grew up with my Aunt Hermina, who was in Auschwitz with the numbers on her arm. And for some reason, like, The Producers was like such a revelation as a kid. Right. And even as an adult, because it just showed you can make fun of the most insane, horrible crimes and still have fun with it. And, you know, and I was thinking about it on the way here, and I was thinking about how radical it is because, you know, I also work as a screenwriter and I think about studio notes. And I was like, if I tried to write The Producers, the first thing they'd be like, now you're not addressing that Max Bialystock is Jewish. And, you know, and you're making a Jew into a crook who is exactly what the Nazis would say he does, like a Jewish guy who fucks old ladies and steals their money. As like, so he can't be Jewish would be like the first studio note.
Right.
Like, and then if he is Jewish, how does he reconcile him like doing a Hitler musical with being Jewish? And does he learn a lesson at the end, which of course he doesn't, you know? And I just, you know, it made me think of, you know, did you guys ever read Mouse?
Yeah,
the Art Spiegelman. Cause I read that whenever it came out, I think I was in high school. And I remember even with that being like, wait, his dad's a Holocaust survivor, but he's a bad guy also. And I'm like, but you can't be a Holocaust survivor, not be a saint, you know? And you can, but you can be an asshole. So, and it's not like the Holocaust in Mouse caused him to be an asshole.
No, in fact, I mean, the interesting thing about that was that the same character traits that made him an unbearable father are what allowed him to survive.
Right.
I mean, that's the interesting, you know, that's the human thing.
Yeah.
Which is so nice. I don't, Joe, do you know anything? I feel like The Producer's history is a bit of a blank spot for me in terms of what they went through to get it made. Cause I can't imagine even then that was.
Well, that's not a studio picture. You know, it was an embassy picture.
Okay.
So that's, I don't know how much Joe Levine had to do with it cause he was at that place at the time. But it's like a New York indie.
Right.
And there was a whole, all the cast and everybody, they're all New York people. And I think there was, when it first came out, there was some talk about taste.
Some talk. You know?
I don't think it played well in the hinterlands.
Right.
You know, I don't think there was a lot of drive-in use for The Producers. But, you know, any place where people knew who Zero Mostel was, obviously was going to be a place where you could play this picture. And Mostel is, as usual, you know, brilliant in it. It's cinematically, it's not exactly the most stylish movie ever made because Mel was just starting out doing that. He'd done a couple of shorts. He did a great short called The Critic, which was an animated short.
Right, right.
Which is a guy with a heavy Jewish accent is talking at the screen during a sort of a abstract cartoon. You know, yeah. saying things like, "Who made this? The guy makes could make a shoe. Why would he make this?" Mm-hmm. And he, you know, had the
12 chairs.
He had 12. The 12 chairs was, I think, his first picture. And then he had the Carl Reiner bit with the 2000-year-old man. And so he was pretty well known as a comic on TV. And I think that the producers took a little time to sink in, you know. But then the idea of making it into a Broadway play obviously happened way after that.
Yes.
It had to become a cult movie first.
Yeah, for decades. But the idea that, you're right, I can't imagine that going through a studio system.
No.
And in any era.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like astonishing because, they're both just terrible and they end up terrible and they're happy terrible. And and it's like, that's the way the world should be portrayed because that's how it is. But the fact that you can also like take the power away from Nazis by, you know, just mocking them but not like doing it and like having a moment where someone goes, no, Nazis are bad people, like so much stuff, So obviously that was, wonderfully scarring in my childhood because I went to an old Jewish high school or most.
How old were you when you saw that?
Probably like 13 or 14. And I just remember every year, being like, "Oh, producers, it's going to be on TV again. Let's watch it." So, and singing "Springtime for Hitler" at school, So,
yeah, no, that's just pretty revelatory. I don't know why I was the first time I saw it too, and it always sticks with me. I think it was the first time I ever saw William Hickey in anything.
He's so good in it.
Such an interesting presence.
Yeah,
he was always 62. in everything.
Yeah, he never aged, but he started aged.
Yeah.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
So, all right. Shall we go for a more obscure one?
Mm.
Okay, here's...
Go deep, man.
Okay, I won't go too deep yet, but the Monkees movie Head.
Not since the Ten Commandments. If you liked Covered Wagon... Beyond From Here to Eternity. They can't be the Marx Brothers, they're too young. Columbia Pictures presents The Monkees. Mickey, Davey, Mike, Peter in Head. That's right, Head.
I saw probably 16 years old on acid at the Thalia Cinema in New York. And
so you were the target demographic.
It was so great. And it was a double feature with Dr. Strangelove. And and I remember just being like, man, Dr. Strangelove really sucks compared to Head. Like Head just was so multi-layered on acid. And Dr. Strangelove, I get the... I also saw at that point Risky Business on acid, which is not good at all on acid.
I would think being...
I was just like, at the end, I was like, this is a total pro-materialism story. I was like, this is awful. I fucking hate this. This is like, I don't know what made me want to see that on acid. Fantasia was the first time I took acid.
Well, that's the obvious, yeah.
And
2001.
But we did do 2001, but we didn't. It was the first time doing acid. No one had told us that it takes about 2 hours to hit. So like 10 of my friends go in, we all take the acid, and we're just like waiting. Yeah, we're just like... Nothing's happening.
And now the movie's over.
And then the movie's over. And we're like, well, LSD is a stupid drug. It certainly doesn't affect you at all. And we literally walk out of the theater. And as we all said, it does affect us. It just kicked in. And we're like, fuck.
Let's watch the movie again.
Yeah. We missed the movie. Like, what's the point? Like, we just kept seeing the movie and be like, this is really not a trippy movie at all. But Head was like, it was pretty much like, rush into like Buddhism, like all the principles of Buddhism on acid came through in Head, and I like made all the revelations that you'd have to spend like 10 years in an ashram making. And, like, I was just like, okay, this is all about like, you know, the stupidity of materialism and how like nothing actually has any meaning. And then for years I was scared to see it again because I thought it wouldn't be as good again.
Right.
Because we also, I remember on acid listening to the first Frank Zappa record and being like, this is the greatest record ever. And then a week later, I was just like, let's listen to it again and be like, this record sucks. And a few years later at college, I programmed Head because I was like the person who programmed all the movies at college and went and was just like, it's still great.
Yeah.
And, you know, and its politics are really amazing. Have you guys seen it recently? Do you remember?
Well, yeah, I've seen it recently. Okay. But in fact, I was just, for some reason, about a month ago, I was looking for it on Blu-ray, and you can only get it in
the package.
In packages of either the, yeah, the, there's a criterion of all the Burt, I don't know what it's got, like Drive, he said, and Last Picture Show, and a bunch of others. Or you can buy the entirety of the Monkees TV show, and Head comes as a supplement.
But
there's no way to get it on its own as a Blu-ray, which is frustrating. But it's been a long time since I've seen it. But yeah,
I mean, the editing's incredible. I showed it to my girlfriend a few days ago, and she was like, and it has the most crazy edit, I think. I mean, it's got like what I'd say is like Russ Meyer editing. It's just like super fast.
Right.
And there's this thing where at the very beginning of the movie, they have like different TV screens appearing. And they do this mockery of the Monkees theme, but it's like, hey, hey, we're the Monkees, a manufactured product with no philosophy. It's like, it's kind of exactly the same thing as like the Sex Pistols, Great Rock and Roll Swindle. They're saying the same thing, but it's much more fucked up. And it's cutting to them like from different scenes from the movie. And it all seems like it's going to be fun. And then it cuts to this image from Vietnam, the famous image of the guy shooting the Viet Cong guy on the street. Yeah. And it's just like, you think you're going to see a monkey. I mean, I can't imagine like Monkees fans going there and you see them murder this man on screen. And then it cuts to a woman screaming, a teenage girl screaming in what you think is horror. And she's just screaming. You're like, that was horrible, horrible. And then it zooms out and she's at a Monkees concert screaming at the Monkees as they're on stage. And you're just like, oh my God, this is like, they're just saying we're manufactured.
Right.
And like, you know, the Beatles never did anything that daring and they were manufactured in
last
their own
train
way.
From Da Nang.
Yeah.
You two can be dandruff on Victor Mature's
head. Yeah.
Victor Mature, that's right.
But it has another sequence where there's a Mike Nesmith song and it's girls screaming and it just keeps cutting to like Vietnam footage. And you're just like, whoa, it's I don't know. It's, I saw it again a few months ago at the Egyptian with Mike Nesmith.
I'll try. He should, yeah.
And Mickey there. And they left. They didn't watch the movie. Apparently they went to get drunk and they come back and they're like, yeah, this movie, I don't think they'd seen the movie since 1968 or whatever it came out. They go, yeah, this movie was weird. Like Bob Rafelson wanted to put this Vietnam footage, but we didn't let him put it in there. And we're like,
that's hilarious.
Yeah. So I think that was one of the, you know, key movies in my life. It's like, okay, it's great pop music, but it's just like, it's like makes you laugh. And then suddenly it's just like, and here's commentary on like war and consumerism and all this kind of stuff. And I just loved it and think Bob Rafelson's best movie, which I'm sure he would like to hear.
No, it's great. It's great. God damn it. Someone's got to put it out on its own. It's making me crazy.
It is on YouTube right now. If you want to check it.
In HD. I'm sure
it's all in HD, but
it's not that I don't like the Monkees TV show, but you know,
well,
a little
goes a long way.
Yeah. What am I going to watch every episode of the
Monkees? They're all the same episode. This is the problem.
I tried to rewatch the TV show a few years ago and Head holds up, but the TV show doesn't. Yeah. And the greatest thing is, you know, like I have friends who are boomers and they just literally like shit their pants and then take the shit out and rub it over their faces. If you mention how great the Monkees are, they're like, no, they're not, they're ripping off the Beatles. I'm like, well, the Beatles were ripping off the Everly Brothers. Come on. Like, you know, everyone rips off someone. And I've had this reaction whenever, like, I try and tell certain people over a certain age that, you know, the monkeys are great, and they're just like, no, it's hilarious.
Well, they had a lot of good songs. I mean, Voice and Heart were really good.
And Carole King.
Yeah.
Like they had basically all of the, I was talking to a writer named Dominic Priori, who's like a big 60s writer. He goes, if you love the Beatles, you have to love all the like girl groups and Brill Building bands that influenced the Beatles. And basically the Monkees hired all those Brill Building people who influenced the Beatles to write songs influenced by the Beatles. So it's just like a perfect circle kind of thing where it's just like, cause it's Carole King and all these people. And
also, or like Martin Scorsese making The Departed based on a Hong Kong film. That's an homage to Martin Scorsese.
Exactly. Yeah. And I love the Porpoise song in that movie. It's just like my favorite psychedelic song. And basically I have to get an MRI every year. And the only way I can calm down before an MRI is
this
playing the Porpoise song. Because I'm like, I'm not going underwater. I'm going kind of underwater into a horrible little machine.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So, okay. Well, you want another one?
No, we're done.
You're done? Okay. I grew up obviously loving Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers and then also Gene Kelly. But I kept trying to think, like, do any of these movies have politics? And they really are scrub-free of politics. There's like...
Well, that's its own kind of politics.
Yeah. And it's weird because all those Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies are at the height of the Depression, and it's just rich people in top hat, white tie, and tails.
Well, but that's the escapism. I mean, that's one of the reasons they were so popular.
Probably.
Who had floors like they did? I mean, those floors are always clean and shiny.
Yeah. No, I mean, I love them, but I'm just like, there was not even like the hint of like any social commentary in them. But later, I don't know, probably in college, I discovered, I might have seen 42nd Street in high school, but later I discovered Gold Diggers of 1933.
What you said, you let us think that...
What did I let you think? I told you I had a great show, and I have. It's always the way. I got the show, I got the music, I got the cast, I got the theater, all rearing to go, and it's the old, old story. Money.
I'm not kidding. I'll give him the money. He'll have it in his office at 10:30 tomorrow morning.
Where are you going to get $15,000?
We'll make those guys pay for their fun. Right through the checkbook.
Underneath your...
What do you know about me underneath?
I
know what you mean, you old sugar. You watch out. I'm falling in love with you. And oh boy, when love comes at my age. Guess who?
Which I rewatched this week because I just always remembered. Do you remember the Remember Your Forgotten Man?
Oh, yeah, it's a great number.
Oh, is that the one? Yeah.
And that's Warner Brothers. I mean, they were socially conscious. RKO is, now let's just make whatever they like.
Yeah. But it's really daring. Like, imagine did when we had like, the last economic housing crisis, or even today. Has there been like a major, did La La Land have a major musical number about how homelessness is affecting us, right? Or how like people came back from like the Iraq war and ended up homeless. I mean, it's pretty crazy. And, do you remember this movie?
I remember that scene. Yeah.
It's basically about these showgirls who are going broke and like can't afford food and they get booked in a show and basically it turns out that Dick Powell, who's written the music, is forced to be in the show and doesn't want to. And they all think it's because he's a bank robber. And they're kind of excited because no one can figure out how he had the money to pay for the show. And then it turns out he's like this rich Boston scion and his family comes in. And there's stuff that's amazing because his brother comes in to break up the marriage. And he says these poor people are parasites. And it's pretty much parasite. They just want to steal our money and steal our possessions. And he's fully like Mitt Romney. And he's trying, he's this Boston Brahmin trying to break up their marriage. And then the rest of the movie is the showgirls, which is Ruby Keeler is in love with Dick Pell, but it's, why am I spacing on her name? Joan Blondell. Mm-hmm. Who's incredible and just has those crazy eyes, and she and this other woman decide to swindle these rich guys, and it's anti-rich people pro-swindling, and then And then at the very end, the whole show ends with this number, Remember You're a Forgotten Man, which is all about homeless, broke people. And Joan Blondell is dressed like a prostitute. Mm. And it's all about, you know, it's kind of got a lot of Brother, Can You Spare a Dime to the song, but it just ends there. It doesn't like come back to the love story.
Right.
It doesn't come back to like the happy part. It's just like, you see all these homeless guys like marching like on sandwich lines, and it's like, and that's the end of the movie. And it's just kind of astonishing. Again, like there were no studio notes saying like, let's tie it up. And like, right, everyone's learned their lesson, you know? So the rich people are never like, I'm sorry, I'm mean to poor people. You know, you know, they want to fuck the showgirls, of course, but they, yeah. So
a lot of, yeah, it was making me think, I guess Hustlers might have a little bit of that kind of vibe these days.
If, yeah.
But it does tie up, and it does teach you lessons. And,
yeah, I guess the big thing, and it's one thing that drives me crazy, is like, I love movies where you don't learn a lesson, where you're just like, yep, the world sucks. And I love surreal stuff like Head, which, yeah, I feel is like, you know, kind of like a Buñuel movie, you know, in terms of, it's very similar to like Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie or something. It's just like, goes from entertaining bizarre setup to entertaining bizarre setup, but, you know, there's no central thing tying it together.
You know, I'm with you. I don't like feeling that heavy hand of you know, someone's going to tell me something.
Yeah.
I don't mind if you tell me something. I just prefer not to, you know, prefer to walk out and go, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
You told me something.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. People seem to want that. So it's, or some people do. So, all right, I'll go for another obvious one. Cabaret.
This was Germany in the early 30s.
Hello, stranger.
Full of life and love.
Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, Ladies und Gentlemen, Fräulein Sally Bowles.
What's great about it is if you've seen the stage musical, have you guys seen it? Yeah. So the stage musical is completely different because all the songs are, the characters break out in song like they do in musicals. And Fosse said, no, we're not going to have any characters break out in song. All the songs will be on stage. And that's what I think made it so interesting at the time. And it's weird, when I went through a big Judy and Liza phase a couple of years ago with my girlfriend, because her favorite movie is Anchors Away. So we started with that, and then we got into The Pirate and watching everything again. And rewatching Cabaret, we watched all the bonus features and stuff. And they were like, yeah, it was really hard for Fosse to get to direct Cabaret. They didn't want him to direct it because his previous movie was such a failure, which was Sweet Charity.
Sweet Charity, yeah.
And so I was like, it was a failure?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was like, how could it be a failure? It's Fosse. And I rewatched it and I was like, this movie sucks. Really, there's good musical numbers, but I don't know how he got, like, you know, such, you know, the performances were bad. And I've never seen a man love, it's like, it's literally like you gave him a zoom lens the first day of shooting. And he's just like, what's this pop zoom thing I can do? And he pop zooms like on every third shot. And you're like, yeah, you got a pop zoom. It's great, you know? So,
did you watch Fosse Verdon?
I did not.
You know, they got into that a bit when him scrambling to get another job and a cabaret going.
It's weird, when I went to see the stage musical recently, and it's, The Liza Minnelli character is much worse person in it. She's a real cocaine addict, and reading about it, the real person that Christopher Isherwood based it on, she wasn't a good singer, but apparently she was so just powerful a presence that everyone was obsessed with her.
Have you ever seen the I Am a Camera
version? I actually haven't. I read the book when I was a kid.
It's interesting. Uh-huh. You know? I mean, it's not as good as Cabaret, but it's interesting, and of course there's no songs.
Yeah. And then when you listen to the commentary, it's great because it's just like,
is Fosse?
No, Liza, like, talking about it. She's like, well, Daddy told me I needed to, because she's always calling Vincent Minnelli Daddy, which, like, and if you watch a lot of Vincent Minnelli movies, there was ones with DVDs with her commentary, and it'll be literally like, and Daddy decided to use the color blue in this movie, and no one had ever used color blue before in a movie. Like, wow. And then like each movie, she'll be like, this is my favorite movie by Daddy. And then you watch the next one with the commentary, and she's like, oh, this is my favorite movie by Daddy. And
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, and Daddy told me I needed to look like Louise Brooks. And and you know, so which he did. Though so yeah.
They're so, gonna find some of those.
Which the
commentaries.
The commentary the
yeah.
We got them at the Santa Monica Public Library. So, like it was just like, oh, we'll watch every one of these. Okay, so all right, here's back to surrealism. And pretty much the biggest influence on Wild and Wonderful Whites of West Virginia that no one will ever realize. It's Lindsay Anderson's Oh Lucky Man, his sequel to If. So
I don't see the line.
have you seen it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So I've
seen it.
Yeah. So basically
I never thought of it as a sequel to If. I mean, it's
not officially. But it's
the next one with that character, but
yeah, they all have the same names, but they're different characters.
Yeah,
and I never saw it on acid, but I saw it in high school a lot of times, and it's
a long movie to run in high school.
Well, I would see it at like you know the Carney Hall Cinema or some like revival.
Not at the AV, not the AV kids with the
no
projectors.
No, like starting in. Sixth grade, I grew up in the Bronx and I discovered revival theaters and was just always going to either like, did you live in New York?
I live in New Jersey.
Okay.
Like, I went to New York as often as possible to escape New Jersey.
Okay. Yeah. So I was always at either the Bleecker Street Cinema, the Thalia.
The New Yorker.
The New Yorker, I think was before. What? Maybe. No, I'm not sure. Carnegie Hall Cinema was the other revival theater. So that I remember going to, but yeah, they would always show Oh Lucky Man, and it's really long. But Alan Price, it has a story, but every once in a while it cuts to Alan Price,
dead on song.
Who was from the Animals, yep. And he's doing these amazing songs that are very much like, they're in the spirit of like the Kinks, Ray Davies kind of political commentary songs. And it just cuts to him over and over again, just singing songs that comment on the scenes. But he's not a character in the story for the first two thirds. And so it's, you know, you have some of that kind of stuff, but it's not like, you know, like in Harold and Maude or like The Graduate, you have these songs, but they're not created for the movie. So they don't really comment as specifically, but these are really commenting specifically on the scenes. And then later in the movie, Malcolm McDowell ends up at this recording studio and meets Alan Price and they're singing and it all kind of ties together. And I was obsessed with that movie and still am. And when I made Wild and Wonderful Whites, I was like, I want to make this into a musical. And
it's a documentary, folks. It's just right. To remind people. Yes.
And we actually, at one point, were going to write a musical number for Jesco because Wild and Wonderful Whites, for the people who haven't seen it, is about a multi-generational criminal family from West Virginia.
In Kentucky.
Not Kentucky. Who are also tap dancers. So Jesco, the dancing outlaw white, is this guy who tap dances to everything from bluegrass to rock and roll. And so I shot all these sequences of him with Hank Williams III. Hank Williams III's playing songs and Jesco's tap dancing to it. So whenever, and all his songs fit in with the theme of the movie because they're all, and we interview him also in it. So he comments on the family. He actually had written a song about the White family, but then he writes these songs about like taking pills and stuff and so you've and fighting and you know and so whenever they start talking about taking pills and fighting and you've got them doing that, I cut to Hank III playing his song and we just show him singing it with Jesco tap dancing to it as direct commentary on what's going on in there. So
funny. I just would never have made the connection, but sure.
Yeah. And so, and there was one more song that was a really dark song that we recorded Hank III singing, but he wouldn't let us put in the movie because it was just like this song about like, you know, he's Hank Williams' grandson and it's a song about him, his grandfather and his dad all being like super destructive, horrible people. So, so that, and of course that movie is super, has all this fucked up anti-capitalist commentary in it. That's just amazing. Cause Malcolm McDowell starts the movie wanting to be a super successful coffee salesman and immediately gets sucked into all this evil stuff as he rises to the top and then is quickly destroyed by, I think it's Ralph Richardson. So
it's a great film. It is a great film. I don't know. I lean a little bit more towards If, but,
you're more into Anarchy?
Maybe. Yeah. I like 90 minute movies that have straight lines.
Oh, you do? Well, If doesn't have that straight line at the end.
Well, it does. It's just, you just don't see it coming. And by the time you're done, you can draw a straight line from A to B. Yeah. But,
another movie no one would even show on TV today.
Yeah.
Like we're going to end a movie with people shooting up their school and they're good guys. Yeah.
The heroes. Yes.
Yeah. I don't even know if you could show Rock and Roll High School now. Right. Like, you know,
yeah, you're blowing things up. That's true.
Yeah.
God, that'd be a fun triple feature of that, Rock and Roll High School and Heathers would be, like movies to get you into trouble.
Yeah. Society does not let you do that anymore. Yeah. I read all that stuff about people being really like younger millennials watching it. Did you read this about it? They watched Heathers and they were like, what is this movie? It's awful.
No.
Yeah. Like they just were like,
oh no, there was one guy who wrote a thing.
Yeah.
Cause Dan Waters wrote Heathers, is a good friend. There was some millennial wrote a piece just tearing it apart. But the sequel to it was all the other millennials on Twitter just demolishing him for attacking their favorite movie. Yeah. So it worked out.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to tell who's just in the Twitterverse is just writing something to get everyone else upset. So.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's time to cancel Wizard of Oz. click.
I'll get to that in a second.
It's problematic, Julian.
Of course. all right. One more? Ready for
sure, him? Yeah.
You know, we have all these jukebox musicals coming out, whether it's like the Queen movie or on Broadway, every single thing was.
Right.
But I realized one of my favorite movies that I watch every year is like probably the first great jukebox musical, which is Amadeus.
Are we going to appall you with something confidential and disgusting? Let's hope so. Because that is what you really like. Unconfessed crimes of buried wickedness. If that is what brings you to us, the prospect of hearing horrors, you shall not go unrewarded.
I don't believe it.
The whole city is talking.
You hear it all over.
What a story.
What a scandal.
What a comedy.
What a tragedy.
Incredible.
I don't believe it.
Who can believe it?
What horrors have you heard?
Tell us.
Tell us.
Tell us at once.
Pretty much. Like, I don't know, almost every time I've got brought a project, I think of Amadeus and like, how can I try and be as smart as Amadeus? And so when I wrote For the Love of a Glove, I pretty much was like Michael Jackson's Mozart and Donny Osmond's the villain in it. And he's right. Salieri.
Salieri, of course.
Yeah. And he's the one making the evil deal with his evil religion to have success. And
you could actually just remake Amadeus with Michael Jackson and Donny Osmond. Without doing much to it. Yeah. That's interesting.
and Amadeus, I consider being against God a political statement. And I think it's not an atheist movie. It's an anti-theist movie. It's pretty much saying God is awful and, and he's a dick and he's not fair. And I just think that's such a powerful, you know, statement and movie. And I've got, actually, it's my girlfriend's copy, so it's kind of what made me really fall in love with her, is she has, like, the director's cut, which is, you know, got an extra 25 minutes of, we watched the original cut, we were like, none of this, the director's cut stuff actually needs to be in there. Like, we're like, my girlfriend's a big believer in the studio cut over the director's cut. She's like, sometimes the studio cut's better. And, but, I don't know, we love even all the unnecessary stuff we love in it. And it's just so well written. And I've scoured the internet trying to find a video of the original stage production because it had Tim Curry starring in it. And I can't even imagine Tim Curry as Amadeus. That just sounds too incredible to me.
Sounds amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. And then there was a version with David Suchet on stage, where David Suchet, Hercule Poirot, plays Salieri, which intrigues me. I wish they would remake Amadeus every 5 years with new people, because I think it's like, I saw at South Coast Rep a version a few years ago, and once again, it was great, but it was like everyone had a completely different take on the characters. And in this one, Salieri had a really good sense of humor. Like, he was like not Miloš Forman's Salieri at all. I'm spacing on the actor's name.
F. Murray Abraham.
F. Murray Abraham, yeah. Who's just so pompous. Yeah. This guy really had a sense of humor about how fucked he got by God. It was just chuckling.
I've never seen the show. How close to the play is the movie?
It's pretty close. Yeah. It's got some changes, and I can't remember. I've read the play a bunch of times, and now I can't remember what they are. It's got some different stuff. The weird stuff is Peter Schaefer, every like 10 years would rewrite it and have a revelation, and it would have different, I think it had three different endings or something, which is pretty bold. But you know, the central themes are all the same. Right. But this one, like the guy who played Salieri, actually I like better than Amadeus, because the guy who played Amadeus played him as kind of like this dumb surfer guy. And you're just like, you really like Salieri better in that version than you do in the movie, where you really like Tom Hulce. And so yeah, it's I think its intelligence is something that, once again, you don't see too often in movies.
Yeah.
Too many notes.
Yeah, too many notes. No,
but stay away from the director's cut, you're saying.
No, I love the director's
cut.
Oh,
okay.
Yeah. No, his girlfriend doesn't like it.
Your girlfriend, okay.
She likes it too, but she admits those 20 minutes do not, those, that
they
cut
didn't
20
need
minutes
it. Yeah.
Doesn't hurt
yeah.
the movie. Like, it does not have
well,
to
those
be
things,
3 hours.
It's so often, it's like, it's when did the director cut it is the important question too. You know, are we looking at the director's cut they made 15 years later after they've gotten tired of looking at it, or was it wrestled from their hands by the studio and fucked up? I mean, it's,
yeah,
it doesn't always, I love the Cobras, but the director's cut of Blood Simple is 3 minutes shorter than the actual, the theatrical release.
I saw my first movie and I was just like, and I remember how hard it was to cut it down. And then I watched it again. I was like, I would cut another 30 minutes out of this movie. This movie should be an hour long, not an hour and a half. I was like, God damn it. So like, there was obviously the first, it was like an indie movie. So the first thing was the director's cut, but now the older, wiser director's cut would cut half an hour.
At least but you should announce that that's what it is.
Yeah, so exactly. Did you, cause I heard you talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Did you go see the extra long version?
I have not seen the extra long version.
Okay.
What happens?
I don't know, because
I understood that the extra long version has stuff at the end. It's just more stuff at the end.
Oh, it's not like
more commercials and
oh, is that stuff. Just,
yeah,
it's not in between.
Apparently, like who are the famous actors who were cut out of it?
There were some folks. Tim Roth.
Tim Roth, those scenes are not in there. So apparently, it's
it's like a 5-hour version.
It's like a marketing play.
On Netflix is my understanding. Breaking up into a series, which
yeah,
have we talked about that? I mean, I had the weirdest. You know, the first time I saw it, I was like, I remember, you know, fucking Brad Pitt going to Panama City, just endless.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, I watched it again while my wife was out.
Uh-huh.
It was on the Academy streaming channel, and I just want to see the first 5 minutes of it for some reason. And ended up watching the entire movie again and loving it, because it was like I had no expectation of it going anywhere.
Yeah.
It does finally, but I remember the moment I realized how much the expectation and everything had changed when I'm watching the film was this is only a month later, I now wanted Brad Pitt to take longer to drive to Panama City. So I thought, okay, so it's about what you go in expecting to some degree. It's, you know, no plot.
The best thing is I saw it with my friends Johnny and Barbara, and Barbara's Czech. And she saw the completely different movie than anyone else, because she never heard of the Manson family and didn't know there was Eddie.
Well, that's there's people who don't know that.
Yeah. And so, like, I'm sitting there where they're at Spawn Ranch, like, on Pins and Needles, and I'm trying to, like, flash back to eighth grade when I read Helter Skelter. I'm like, did they kill a stuntman? Is there something? Yeah. I knew they killed someone at Spawn Ranch at some point, and I was like, are they going to kill Brad Pitt? Are they going to kill him? And then when he got out of there, I was like, oh, God, thank goodness. Yeah. But, like, the first time you see Charlie, you're just like, oh, Charlie. And she was like, okay, who's that guy? And then, like, at the end, they all get, you know, I guess I can ruin the movie for anyone in this, but whatever the ending is.
Quentin does not like when people spoil movies on podcasts. I happen to know that from personal experience.
Okay. Well, the ending, did not seem like a surprise. It did not seem like a surprise because...
Well, because she didn't think of those people as evil because she didn't know what the backstory was.
She did know who Sharon Tate was or Charles Manson because she grew up in Prague during communist era.
And right.
Like, you know, like, well,
then,
like,
when you might say this is not a movie for her.
Or it's more interesting.
Or it's like, more, yeah. I mean, there's plenty of people loving the film who don't know any of that.
So yeah. Kind of interesting. I mean, on my new musical, For the Love of Glove, you know, it's also kind of an alternative history of Michael, but like this imagined Michael was a good guy and the gloves were the bad guys. And we've had 20-year-olds who just, you know, are just like, have no idea about, they've heard of Michael Jackson because he died.
They've heard songs.
They've heard, well, we had one person who's a guy in his 70s who came with like one of our producer's family. And it was like, I don't really know Michael Jackson. I think I saw him on Ed Sullivan one time. And you know, like, so he had a different experience than like all of us who get like,
I wonder what that experience is.
Yeah. He's like a linguistics professor. So he probably was like so intellectual. He was just like, well, I don't
wasn't
see
paying attention
to popular culture.
Yeah.
And our 20-year-olds are like, now why are the elephant man's bones in the script? Like, you know, like, you know, what's this about like sleeping in a hyperbaric chamber? Cause they have no idea what's true or not. And one of our cast members, Tracy Dory, who plays Jermaine Jackson, is 21 years old, and he'd never heard of the Osmonds. And I played him One Bad Apple, which is an exact ripoff of the Jackson 5 sound. And he just started screaming in anger. He just like, he was like, I thought you made this up. This is ridiculous. And so it's fun. Just like, you know, like, because Amadeus, like, how many of us knew all the stuff about Amadeus? Because
Right.
And the other great thing about Amadeus, going back to it, is it's the perfect metaphor for working in Hollywood. And
too many notes.
Yeah. And I read the biography.
Literally, too many notes.
Yeah, because the emperor is the studio exec giving you the stupid notes.
Right.
And I read the biography of Mozart's lyricist who wrote, you know, Don Giovanni's lyrics and stuff. And he was this awesome Italian. He was an Italian poor kid who was really smart, so the only way to get an education was to become a priest. So he became a priest and started writing poetry and then lyrics. And
because he couldn't become a prize fighter, as you see, either become a priest or a prize fighter.
Yeah, and but he loved fucking women, so he, you know, he was always getting in trouble because he was fucking every woman he could. And but he got driven crazy by studio notes on all these operas, which came from the crowd, and you just like you read it, and you're just like, no, they're not going to give him notes on, you know, on this one, like, you know, and you're like, yep, there's the Don Giovanni notes from the emperor. And then like, you know,
can he have a dog?
Yeah. I was just like, nothing's changed. It's like, it was the same shit. It's 1790, you know,
God damn it.
It's just like, it's really shocking when you read this stuff. So. And finally, he gave up, moved to America, and opened a grocery store. I was like, I can't take it anymore. So, you know. But
that's so depressing.
Yeah.
That's so depressing.
So.
You like to think there's hope for, you know.
No, there's no hope.
Things getting better.
The power always.
Abandon hope, all ye who enter.
So if we're teaching you anything this week.
I think, you know, every day I'm like, if there was money in spoken word poetry, like, you know, then. You wouldn't have to raise money. You wouldn't have to get notes. You just go to the coffee shop and you're done. So, okay. Here's one I think I'll stump you guys on. So you've seen That's Entertainment, right?
Mm-hmm. Which, and two and three.
Yeah. Well, what if there was That's Entertainment, but for Soviet communist musicals? And There is a documentary called East Side Story that I love.
That's right.
Have you seen it?
I've got a DVD of it.
Oh,
yeah, there you go.
Have you seen Circus? I was like, do I talk about that or Circus, which is an early 30s Soviet musical?
That I haven't seen.
Okay, so it's in that movie. And after, so the East Side Story is a documentary about.
And it's the same format, musical. Basically, as That's Entertainment. It's
yeah.
It's all just clips from, you know, Soviet era entertainments.
And I love them all because all the early Soviet ones have these political messages and they're all like, and the musicals are like the happy tractor drivers and stuff, like, you know, and they're all very much like, you know, about working people and stuff. And East Side Story, it's weird. All the 30s stuff is really great. Then you go to like the 50s East German musicals or 60s, actually. There's one that's got, it's the opening sequence of East Side Story, and it's really great, but it's lost all the politics. It's just a musical that takes place in East Germany. And I love seeing, you know, I love the, you know, or especially like seeing this world that you don't have any idea what it's like, because it's so simplified in America. Like in this movie Circus, which is like a 1932 musical, which I just watched again. It's on Amazon Prime. And people are living in these Art Deco apartments in like communist, you know, Soviet Union. But it's about this American woman, and it starts in America, and she's running, holding a baby while a crowd is screaming they want to kill her. And she jumps on a train just as the crowd's about to kill her. And that's like the tease. And then suddenly she's in the circus in Russia, and she works with this German guy who wears, it's almost got a little bit of Freaks to it too. He is like, runs her act, and he looks like this big guy, but then when he leaves the stage, he takes off his jacket and he's got this vest that he puffs up with air to make himself look big. And basically the act one, you keep seeing, like, he keeps saying she doesn't want to be with him, and he's blackmailing her into being his lover. And at the end of the first act, you find out that the baby you saw her running with, that you never saw the baby, is mixed race. And he's just blackmailing her, saying, I will let everyone know you had sex with a black man and destroy your life. And she ends up falling in love with, starting to learn about communism and how great Russia is, and wants to stay in Russia. And the German guy keeps blackmailing her to leave, and she falls in love with this other guy. There's a bunch of comic twists, but at the end, he decides to reveal who she is, and he brings out her kid, who's at that point like 4 years old. And it's kind of crazy when you think about Russia today, like the most racist fucking place. But basically, the crowd steals the kid from him, and they start singing. This is the end of the movie. I hope it's not ruining it. This lullaby to the kid to help it sleep. Mm-hmm. And then the evil German guy runs up to try and grab the baby from each person, and they just pass it to the next person, who sings the lullaby in a different language of the Soviet Union. So like one person singing Russian, the next person is singing it in Yiddish. Like you're like, right, that sounds like German, and they look Jewish. Then like it passes to like an Asian person who sings it, then passes it to a black person who sings it. And he's just like, why aren't you upset? And they're like, we in the Soviet Union don't care about race.
Yeah, them commies were way more enlightened than we were.
Yeah.
And yeah. Yep.
And the happy ending is like all the people sing together, like they don't care about race. They were, you know, one people fighting.
And what year's the film?
32.
30.
I mean, it's.
Think about.
Yeah.
Wow.
Same year as Freaks.
Yeah. And it's got all that kind of like those early 30s movies still have all that silent cinema, like photography, where it's just like really bold, weird choices in terms of like framing and angles. So anyway, so that's
Circus, a movie you will not hear discussed on any other podcast.
Yeah, probably not. Mm-hmm. And that parts of that are it's referenced in East Side Story.
Basically, I saw East Side Story, and then I went on eBay and found a guy who, this is back in the day, who sold VHSs of, and I think they came from Poland. And I was ordering
for either of them today. Or are they?
There's a bunch of them you can find on Amazon now, but back in the day, it was going on eBay, finding a guy in Poland who would send you a VHS to watch them. So, but yeah, there's a few on Amazon for sure, including Jolly Fellows and Volga, and and I don't know, I love that kind of weirdness where you get to see a totally different culture, but it's a musical, and so it has something you know, but then it's got weirdness.
So it's got subtitles.
Yeah, subtitles. Yeah. So,
you okay with that?
That's fine with me. It's hard to watch with no subtitles.
Yes,
you don't speak.
I cannot do
that. Oh, yeah, you can get it used on Amazon for. That is East Side Story.
Yeah. So another movie that really influenced me that I think is also political, and it's and I was lucky enough to see it in college because one of my best friends, Chris Ivanko, his brother went to school with Todd Haynes and produced was Superstar, the Karen Carpenter story. And if anyone hasn't seen it, it's
gotta be on YouTube, right?
I think it is.
You can't see it
legally.
Legitimately.
So, but it's Karen Carpenter's life story told with Barbie dolls.
Yes.
And that was and obviously my new musical is done with a lot of puppets. Yeah. And that was one of the like formative experiences being like, whoa, you could do this. Like you can comment on a celebrity, you know, make fun, but also like really be compassionate to what they went through and deal with gender politics and do it all with Barbie dolls. And
well, you can almost do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Except for, except for Richard Carpenter, not letting you use the movie.
Except for being able to sell it. Ever. Yeah.
So, and I've seen other people make movies with dolls and they always turn out terribly. Like they're just like, oh, I made, you know, someone else's story with dolls. And you just like, you try it. You get bored like 7 minutes in and for some reason, I don't know how Todd Haynes did it, but the whole movie's fascinating.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
Just watching Barbie dolls with like no movable mouths or anything, acting out Karen Carpenter's story. And it's just such a great commentary and like what women are taught in terms of beauty. Cause you know, obviously I've seen a lot of bad art with Barbie dolls too. Like where you're just like, yeah, we get it. Like, yeah, Barbie dolls are presenting an unhealthy image of femininity to women, but with Karen Carpenter, it makes sense. Yeah. So that's another movie, that, scarred me.
Yeah,
scarred me. I'm almost done. I'm almost at number nine.
Number nine.
And I watched this one again last night, and I watched the director's cut, which was not as good as the original cut, which is Space is the Place. Have you seen that?
No, you mentioned
it. Is that the Sun Ra movie?
Yeah, the Sun Ra movie.
Oh, God. I knew the editor. She was editing it down the hall.
No way.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know do you guys know who Sun Ra is?
Most people don't, I don't think, remember Sun Ra.
It's so sad. No, he was putting out like 10 records a year on his own label. Like, they were just like, he was churning them out.
Yeah.
I mean,
but nobody was listening.
No one was listening. Yeah. Like, well, except like people like the MC5 and the Stooges. Yeah, the Stooges all loved Sun Ra. And so
1993, I don't know what's wrong with me.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, for people who don't know, Sun Ra was this jazz musician who was born in Alabama named Sonny Blunt, and at some point in the 50s, he realized that he wasn't from Earth; he was from Saturn, and he went from being Sonny Blunt, Herman Sonny Blunt, to Sun Ra, spelled Sunra, and he started wearing space clothes and Egyptian clothes, a combination of the two, and all his music was about being from outer space and. And he just started writing like the most bizarre free jazz. And he basically started his own cult because he was based in Philly. So I don't know if you knew that.
Absolutely. For a long time. He played a lot of clubs there. And I remember there was a moment when I realized that Sun Ra was not, just a local band.
Uh-huh.
You know, 'cause there's all these bands there and you're like, yeah, no one knows who these guys are. And then you realize that people, if not all over the world, at least there are people around the world who are familiar and following him. Yeah.
Yeah. So he, you know, by the 50s, everyone's like, a giant orchestra doesn't make financial sense.
Yeah.
like the Benny Goodman days are over. And Sun Ra was like, nope, I'm going to have the Sun Ra Orchestra.
Yes.
And so he always had like 15 to 20 people in his band, which for a band that's not very popular is financially a really bad idea. And they all lived in a house in Philly together that one of the members' mom let them do. And he basically, the guys were not allowed to leave the house. They just had to rehearse 12, 14 hours a day and do nothing else. They weren't allowed to have sex. They weren't like allowed to like do drugs. And it was all about the music. But amazing musicians would end up joining the orchestra and say, like, I've never learned more about music than working with Sun Ra. And he developed his own philosophies. And I guess that in the 60s, someone brought him to Berkeley to give these lectures. And his philosophies are very bizarre. And he like speaks in like these weird Zen koans that are great. And someone saw him and said, let's make a movie, a blaxploitation movie starring Sun Ra. And so Sun Ra was like, sure. And he's really weird. You can't tell how.
So it's not a doc?
It's not a documentary. And it's basically, it's got a little bit of Jodorowsky about in it. It's got a little Ingmar Bergman. It's Sun Ra. So Sun Ra, the Bergman part is Sun Ra is playing cards, but it's like with tarot cards against the overseer, who's this like very dapper black guy who basically is a stand-in for like the you know, the successful political black man who like, you know, works for the community, but is obviously evil. And also, and the weird thing is I watching the director's cut, there's a whole subplot that seems to make him almost be a pimp. And it was written by a white guy. So I think the white guy was seeing all these other blaxploitation movies like the bad guy has to be a pimp. And in the Sun Ra cut, he cut out all the pimp stuff and the gratuitous nudity. And I love gratuitous nudity, but I'm actually, this was one where it's like, yeah, I didn't need it. And so it's basically, they're in this field playing this game for who will control the black community, and the evil overseer or Sun Ra. And Sun Ra, like, so Sun Ra, when the movie begins, he's disappeared for like 5 years and he shows up in his spaceship on Earth to come to help liberate black people. And NASA is freaking out by it. They're like, we don't want this happening. And he's saying he's going to take all black people away from America and take them to like his own planet where they can live freely. And it's just, it's really political. And it's just like really fucked up, like to think about, like, because he keeps saying like, we black people just have to leave Earth. It's just like, there's no way we're ever going to get justice. We have to find our own planet and live there. And, but then he says this weird poetic things. Like he's going around to youth centers and talking to people. He's like, are you happy? And they're like, we're not happy. He's like, that's because you're not listening. He goes, every one of us is a musical instrument. And if you're not playing the proper music, you're not, you know, aligning with the like astral chord progressions that you need to be in. And his spaceship is powered by free jazz. So he has to play free jazz to fly his spaceship. And NASA wants to find out how it works and he won't tell them. And it's heavy. It's beautiful. It's got all this depth. It's got like his weird sense of humor because he starts his own employment agency called like the Interplanetary Employment Agency, where he's trying to get people to leave Earth with him. And I mean, the only thing I can compare it to in weirdness, even though it's weirder, is like Petey Wheatstraw, the devil's son-in-law. Like it's got that whole like, you know.
And where did you see this recently?
I have the DVD.
Oh, you have the DVD.
There's actually a friend of mine, David Katz Nelson, re-released it with like a giant book of archival photos. And it's got that early 70s color where it's just like, oh, it's just, it's beautiful. Yeah. So.
That's awesome.
Well, I can't believe you guys have not seen
Space
as a Place.
Yeah, no, it's stumped there. Yeah, I'm just looking at the thing here. It's science fiction, blaxploitation, free jazz.
Yeah.
I'm in.
Yeah, and the Sun Ra cut is only 62 minutes, which is...
Oh, I'm really in.
Which is really, like, I watched an hour and a half cut last night, and I was like, I mean, it's, yeah, it's ambling and weird, and like some points you're like, okay, let's get back to Sun Ra doing weird stuff. And then I'll end with the obvious one, the one that like probably was the first musical I saw, which is The Wizard of Oz. And
nope.
Nope. You haven't seen it?
Nope.
I stumped you again.
Nope. Not allowed to do that.
Yeah. And, you know, and years ago, I'd always thought there was a lot of politics in Wizard of Oz. And do you guys know about this stuff at all?
I've seen the film.
So it's basically Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas made into a movie. Come on. Like, you've got like, you go to Kansas and right. it's miserable and black and white. And
right.
dusty and a shithole, and it's filled with terrible people. And the studio ending, of course, kind of ruins it, even as a kid, the whole like, and then I woke up, I always thought it was stupid, even as a kid. But
yeah, who wanted to be back there when he could be?
Yeah, who wants to go back there? Yeah. But I think it just really said, like, those black and white sequences say everything you can about like Kansas and how people there just say there's no place like home, but there is. There is a lot better.
Or and there you are could better places.
There's a lot yeah. better places than like living on a dusty farm where you can't grow crops. But and then like I feel like, you know, the politics of it is really obvious. I mean, like, and for you, I was just thinking, my girlfriend was like, don't say this, people are gonna think you're crazy. But I was just like, pretty much it's like Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton. It's like the Wicked Witch of the West.
And the phony wizard.
The phony wizard who's all pompous and is just like full of shit. Wow. And like
how prescient.
You know, it's just like, or you know, it's pretty much all American politics explained right there.
That's hilarious.
And as I started looking into it, there was a lot of stuff in there that's, well, first of all, what you were saying about banning stuff, Falwell tried to ban The Wizard of Oz.
Sure. Yeah.
Because, and they were upset about it when it came out because it's like, there are no good witches.
Right.
And there's, and as I did more research into it, first of all, L. Frank Baum was a big feminist. His mother-in-law was a famous suffragette. And so the idea that you have this female heroine who triumphs, not by falling in love with Prince Charming or anything, you know, but just there's no love interest.
Right.
She succeeds. She's smarter than any of the dudes.
Yeah.
And it turns out L. Frank Baum was a political writer before he became a children's storybook writer. And the guy who illustrated the books was a political cartoonist. And you know, he never explicitly said it, but apparently it's all about politics in the 1890s. So basically, it's when William Jennings Bryan, the theory is that William Jennings Bryan is a lion. And basically the scarecrow is the farmers of America
right.
Fighting against the gold standard, which is the yellow brick road. The tin man is the industrial workers of America who've been like frozen in rust because they don't get any oil. And in the book, she's not wearing ruby slippers, which was invented for technical. Yeah. She was wearing silver slippers.
Yep.
And they're on the yellow brick road and they end up at the Emerald City, which is green dollars. And so it's like all a metaphor about the silver and gold fight going on in the 1890s. And then L. Frank Baum also was a theosophist who'd left Christianity. So it also deals with all these theosophical issues, which including that they all believe that religion, the original female-led religions, matriarchal religions, were suppressed by making witches bad. So he restored witches to their power position. But in the end, the movie is really about don't trust leaders, don't feed parking meters, whatever. Everyone's like, oh, the great and wonderful Oz will fix it for you. And then you get to Washington, D.C., and the guy's full of shit.
Yeah, you gotta fix it yourself.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he's a liar and he's going to trick you into like getting killed, going into a war with the witch, you know? And I don't know. I think it's, you can make a good case that it's a very political movie.
I think you can. Yeah. No, you know, it's funny. I hadn't thought of it. I grew up on those books.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I was into them. And then I weirdly, like 10 years ago, sold Warner Brothers a pitch for a sequel.
Uh-huh.
To Wizard of Oz that included, because Warner owns, you know, the MGM thing, so mm-hmm. we could use things like the ruby slippers and all the rest of that. And it just came out of a conversation. I did not walk into a room wanting to, you know, who does that? But it's funny because but the villain of the thing, and this is 2009, maybe, was essentially Donald Trump. He had discovered a door in his aunt was the, what's her name? The Wicked Witch.
Yeah.
And he had found amongst her things, he found a door to Oz.
Yeah.
And he was exploiting it. He wanted to turn it into a theme park.
And the
sort of thing was, and as he destroys and industrializes Oz, in our world, everybody's imagination starts to die. And so Dorothy's granddaughter has to travel to Oz, get the band back together, and go take down Donald Trump.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. It's
more topical than ever.
Yeah, sadly. Yes. Well, you made a movie, I think, Joe, didn't you? With I feel like there's a Trumpian reference. I made a movie with a
character who
was
somewhat like Donald Trump, the icon, the New York icon, not the crazed lunatic.
We know I'd not seen Gremlins 2 in a while when we did that screening, and it was much nicer to him than he deserved.
Well, he was part Ted Turner also.
Yes.
So that was a mitigating factor. And then the actor who played him, John Glover, was just so likable.
Yeah.
It was like, there was no way this guy was going to really be the villain. So it's not really a accurate representation of Mr. Trump.
Yeah.
But it's not too late for Gremlins 3, the White House.
Yeah.
Must be done.
happening as you speak.
Yeah.
I never liked like all those Disney movies where like the princess has to fall in love with the prince. So I think, you know, everyone's like going crazy for Frozen.
Did you ever see the Walter Murch version? The Return to Oz.
I never did.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Is it good?
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's dark, but it
was a huge disaster.
No, I remember it being a disaster.
Ruined his directing career.
Yeah.
But it's seen today. It's a really very interesting movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it didn't crash for qualitative reasons. I mean, he just went to a very...
It's so dark.
Dark place. Really?
Okay. He's getting electric shock treatments, you know. So
yeah.
Really? Okay. <You know. laughs>
yeah, because she keeps talking about this place. Like, what's the matter with you?
Yeah. It makes sense that people from Kansas don't want to hear about Oz. They're like, wait, there's a really beautiful place with like wonderful stuff. And they're like, nope, you're crazy. Yeah.
But it is interesting. It's always fascinating me how it's, you know, that movie works on every level. There's nothing wrong with it. And there's no romance.
Yeah. There's no romance.
There's no love story.
Well, there's sort of a thing between her and the Scarecrow. Yeah. Really, he's sort of
it's not a full blown
romance, but obviously he's the one that she relates to the most.
Yes, she makes friends, but there's no there's no lovey dovey, and she is
she's the outtakes.
Well, I always thought, this is a weird thing, but I always thought there was weirdness with the Lollipop Guild. Like those guys.
And that dance, that strange dance they do with the steps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so years ago I was on a dating site and you had to like say like sexiest scene in a movie.
No, you didn't.
And everyone said Mulholland Drive. Like it was just like it was Mulholland Drive, Mulholland Drive, Mulholland Drive, Mulholland Drive. I was like, fuck. This is too obvious. And I put two things. I said, When the Munchkins hug Dorothy, and Janet Leigh in the motel in Touch of Evil, when
Jesus. How'd that work out?
Not
for
even
you?
In Psycho. Not even in Psycho, and it's the same motel.
Well, in Touch of Evil, they've got all the Mexican lesbians,
right?
Yeah, never
Mercedes McCambridge and her one day visit to the set.
Yeah,
and you know what? It was a great filter because I got all the weirdos hitting on me and I filtered out all the like norms. So like,
and is this where you met your girlfriend now?
No.
Okay, yes.
That was many years later, but yeah, I just think there's
he was a different person.
Yeah.
I just think there was some weird sexual, like those guys are just really, you could tell they're dirty where they're like, we represent the Lollipop.
What they were up to in the building down the street was, pretty scandalous.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, who wouldn't make it scandalous, right? So.
Someone needs to take another whack at that.
Uh-huh.
Under the Rainbow?
That story.
Under the Rainbow 2?
I think there's not much chance of there being another.
That didn't work.
Under the
radar. Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah, and apparently many of those stories were made up, like, you know.
No.
I don't know.
No, I'm sorry. I don't want to hear that.
Yeah, I don't know. I heard one podcast where you knew the last Munchkin, right? Like
Joe did the last Munchkin?
No, you.
Oh, he
knew
does
the name of the last Munchkin alive.
It was Felix Sulla.
Okay, yeah.
And he passed away. I worked with him.
There you go.
I know that the remainder, whoever the Lollipop Guild came out during the last writer's strike. There were a few of them left.
Really?
2008, and there was a big rally, and the Lollipop Guild came out to support the Writers Guild, which we all thought was really nice.
That's pretty nice, yeah.
Solidarity.
Yeah.
Trans-dimensional solidarity.
Yeah.
Well, Julian.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was fantastic, man.
Yeah. I hope I did okay.
Yeah, yeah, those are great. I've got to track some of them down.
I stumped you guys on two. That's really good.
I'm easy to stump.
I will cut it out.
I was like, do I go really, you know, obscure? And I was like, nah, you know.
We like when you can find, when there's a shot at finding at least.
Yeah. Obscure is great, but if it's completely lost to the ages, then it's kind of difficult to, you know, excite the viewership. But like the Sun Ra movie, I think, you know, people will be able to find.
Yeah. No, you can definitely find that.
It's on DVD. You know, we should have somebody come on and do 10 movies that don't actually exist.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. Or I thought about like 10 movies, you know, starring musicians where it's just like, because I feel like everyone should make one. Like the Spice Girls movie is good. Like, I don't know why.
David Essex made two.
Did he?
Yeah, well, it's Stardust
is the sequel.
That'll be the first one.
What about the Dave Clark 5 movie? Have you seen that?
What's it called?
That's got two titles. Having a Wild Weekend.
Having a Wild Weekend, I have seen.
That's the American title. Catch Us If You Can, I think.
It's sort of a travelogue, but it's fun.
And it's directed by
John Borman.
John Borman, which is so weird. Like, you're just like, and you watch it. I saw it like in high school, and I was just like, I love the Dave Clark 5. I was like, this is good. I bet this will be better than Hard Day's Night. And it wasn't. It was. It's really serious and weird and like
kind of dull.
And dull, yeah.
Oh, there's Slade.
Did Slade make their own movie?
It's a really good film. You can find it. There's a British DVD that you can get if you get the soundtrack album. It comes with the movie. And I'm kidding. Slade in Fire, I think it's called. And it's really sort of gritty, kind of adventures of a grimy working class band, and it's shockingly good.
Wow! And I can't find that.
It's worth looking for. But yeah, that's an interesting subgenre, like
Kiss Meets the Phantom.
Sure.
I thought like that would be my other choice.
Or how about actors in movies that are musicians in movies where they're not playing musicians? That
like Man Who Fell to Earth, or what?
Sure, Man Who Fell to Earth, or Man from Elysian Fields. I guess there's Ned Kelly.
There's a bunch of
Oscar.
But no, but I think the ones where it's the band, where the band plays themselves in a story, which is...
That's all, yeah. Or playing themselves, they just change the name.
Uh-huh, like what?
Oh, I'm like the Slade movie. They're not playing Slade. Well,
isn't Chico Hamilton's Quintet, aren't they in Sweet Smell of Success?
Yeah, but I don't believe that Martin Miller was actually a member of
the he's the ringer. He's the ringer, but the rest of them. Fred Katz is in it. Fred Katz used to do the music for Roger Corman for, you know, Bucket of Blood and
I just saw it too. Is it All Night Long?
That's
the British one. There's a great.
That's a terrific
movie. It's Patrick McGoohan's remake of Othello in the world of.
You've seen that?
50s. Really, I have it on Blu-ray, man.
Really? Is it good?
Yeah. And it's real jazz.
Just look up the trailer on Trailers from Hell.
Okay.
Yeah. All Night Long.
Because years ago, I read Jerry Lee Lewis' book, Natasha's book, because he was
obsessed with Othello or something, right?
No. It happened at the Amundsen, crazily enough. There's a poster if you go in the Amundsen. It's not called, what did you say it was called? It was
All Night Long is the Patrick McGoohan one, but it's a different.
But it's Othello, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought it had a different title, like something Spirit, but. Hmm. But. It was originally a stage play.
Oh, no, this one, I know what you're thinking of, though, when Jerry Lee Lewis plays Iago.
Iago, right?
Yes, I remember this.
Which I just was like,
I would kill to see that.
I would kill to see it. And apparently in the Natasha's book, they mentioned that he was on the Steve Allen show singing as Iago, which was like the greatest.
Which you could only do on the Steve Allen Show.
Yeah. No, here's Jerry Lee Lewis as a yoga.
Yeah. I was like, that is 14 minutes of acid right there. Like, but Patrick McGoohan directed a movie based
that's
on
that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
What's amazing, it's not just, so, you know, it doesn't just move to England in the 50s. It takes place in one night. It's just this one.
Nah, he's talking about a different picture.
Yeah, he's talking about something else. I'm talking about the McGoohan.
Well,
did Jerry Lewis thing get filmed?
Yeah, there's All Night Long is one movie.
Right. But
then there's another movie.
That's Othello with a musical version of Othello. Othello.
Yeah, that's something else.
That Patrick McGoohan directed.
McGoohan directed it.
Oh, wait. Oh.
Yeah.
Good God. Yes. Which I've also, I've also seen and have on Blu-ray. God help me. Yeah, it's terrible. With Richie Havens.
Okay, yeah.
And I can't remember what it's called, and it's not.
It's like Catch Us If You Can. It's
yeah.
It's like Catch My Soul.
Catch My Soul.
Catch My Soul, yeah.
Catch My Soul.
And how do I know this? It's interminable. How have I seen both of these?
I saw it. It was the Cinerama release. I saw it when it came out. I had to review it.
We did it on my weekly movie night last year. It was 2 weeks. We did both Patrick McGoohan and Othello films. And that's how memorable the first one is. I'd forgotten completely.
But the other one's good.
The other one's really good.
It's really good.
Okay, yeah. So the one I wanted to see is terrible. So two hours are saved of my life.
Oh, God, it's interminable. It's like outtakes from Jesus Christ Superstar.
Ugh, I'm like Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah. But
thanks for coming.
Yeah, thanks for coming. Let's go down another rabbit hole sometime. That was fun. Our show was recorded in beautiful downtown Burbank. The official podcast of trailersfromhell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for the Movies That Made Me.
Some think I'm just a clown, but they don't know how wrong they are. I'm the bad motherfucker. Jackson, the world's greatest superstar. Some think I'm just a glove, but they don't know how wrong they are. I'm the bad motherfucker who made Michael Jackson the world's greatest superstar. The world's greatest superstar. The world's greatest superstar.
Hi, I'm Neil.
And I'm Ken.
And we are from the Triviality Podcast, a pub trivia-style game show where a lack of seriousness meets a little bit of knowledge.
Join us each week for an hour-long game of general knowledge trivia featuring special guests from around the world, plus tons of extra themed episodes.
If you want to improve your trivia game,
or you just want to scream at us in your car when we get easy questions wrong,
then we're the show for you. Find Triviality on all your favorite podcast apps.
But you know that, because you're already listening to a podcast.